Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The term fake news became part of the national lexicon during the 2016 election cycle. Then-candidate Donald Trump used it to describe critical coverage from mainstream media. But there are other ways to manipulate the news. A few weeks ago, someone doctored an actual video of the Speaker Nancy Pelosi to make her sound garbled and slurred.
We want to give this president the opportunity do something historic for our country. The fact is, something happened there. So I pray for him and I pray for the United States of America.
Here's the original clip.
We want to give this president the opportunity to do something historic for our country. The fact is, something happened there. So I pray for him and I pray for the United States of America.
The doctored video was quickly debunked, but social media platforms did not immediately respond. UC Berkeley computer science professor Hani Farid focuses on digital forensics and image analysis. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
What do we know about how that video was altered?
Yeah, what we know is it's a pretty low-tech fake. Essentially, all that happened was the video was slowed down by about 75%, so not insignificant. And more likely than not, the audio was tweaked a little bit to get the tone right, to make it sound like Speaker Pelosi. And then it got pushed out onto social media, as these things do, and it racked up on Facebook millions of views, and Facebook has refused to take it down and defended their position. Twitter has refused to take it down and has been silent on the video. And YouTube, in fact, did take the video down.
So you're saying it's pretty low tech. That means we could expect more of this coming up going forward.
I think there's no reason to believe that we won't. In fact, there's already a second slowed down video of Speaker Pelosi that is now making the rounds following this one. We've, of course, been seeing over the last few years a dramatic rise in so-called deep fake technology, which allows you to create fairly sophisticated fakes, unlike this relatively simple fake where you can now start to put words into people's mouths, particularly politicians and candidates. And I think if we've learned anything over the last 2 years, and as you're saying in the lead-in about the fake news phenomenon, is that it's here to stay. And it's here to stay, I think, in part because it works. People are willing to believe it. Social media has not really responded to how to deal with these problems on their platforms. And we've seen the impact in everything from democratic elections to sowing civil unrest to violence against our citizens to fraud. And so I think we have to get a handle on this from many directions, including from the technology to the policy to the legislative.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the technology and the response by social media companies to the doctored video of Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. My guest is Hani Farid. He's a UC Berkeley computer science professor, and he studies the forensics of the and image analysis, digital forensics and image analysis, I should say. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. You know, this was the first time I heard it. I kind of waited to hear it. I'd heard about it and I'd read plenty about it, but I sort of wanted to feel more viscerally what it actually sounds like. And I've never seen Speaker Pelosi after she's had one few, you know, one too many. But it wasn't just that the audio was slowed down. The tone was altered. You can tweak that, too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's pretty relatively easy to do. This is not a sophisticated manipulation, and that should give us pause.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if this was a highly sophisticated fake that was only accessible to a relatively small number of people, that's a manageable threat. But when a lot of people, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people can create these types of fakes, and of course all have access to social media. And there's a third component to about this, so let's talk about that, which is that the White House, the president, his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, amplified this by retweeting. And so now you have really a very dangerous landscape where the average person can create fakes, they can broadcast it to the world, and then it gets amplified by the powers of in this country. And that's a very dangerous game for us, particularly in the lead up to the 2020 election.
Is there any way the sound can be I don't know what the right word is. I want to say encrypted, but I don't know that where because it's digitized, can it be protected?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are technologies, what are so-called control capture technologies, where at the point of recording, you cryptographically sign the content, whether that's an audio or a video or an image. You put that signature on the blockchain, and the only thing you have to know about that is a distributed immutable ledger, and that allows you to authenticate the recording after the fact. Now, in the Speaker Pelosi video, it was fascinating because you could go, and I did this, I found the original recording, which was on C-SPAN, and that's how I figured out that it was manipulated. It was easy. But now you have two videos floating around, and which one is real. But if you use these control capture systems, the campaigns, the studios, whoever's doing the recording can say, look, here is the original recording. There's no question anymore. This is authentic. So I think there are some technological solutions that are available today, and I think the campaigns are going to have to start thinking about how are they going to protect their candidates in the lead up? Because I think that the Speaker Pelosi video was the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. I think this is here to stay, and I think we're going to be seeing more of these shenanigans.
You know, in a way, I'm kind of used to it in a way because covering politics for 30 years, they've been tinting photographs and, you know, blurring them and doing all kinds of things to make someone look horrible and ugly and green and yellow.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
That's
sure.
not
sure.
new, but it's legal.
Yeah, and so you're absolutely right that this is not a dramatically new phenomenon. There's always been funny games played with the images. Whenever you're writing an attack ad, the image is really dark and grainy, and it makes the person look evil. Mm-hmm. We've always been playing games, but this is taking it to a new level now. Where, for example, in the Speaker Pelosi video, they are saying she is drunk and we should impeach her. By the way, her campaign, her office has said she hasn't had a drink since 2010.
Okay.
Not to bring it back into the discussion, but okay. But now you can also start putting words into people's mouths. And this is a whole new ball game. This is not spin. These are not subtle distinctions. These are literally, we are making stuff up now. And then, of course, 20 years ago, we didn't have social media. So when the average person created these fake images, they can send it to 10 of their buddies, but they couldn't amplify to the world to the tune of millions of people. And to those who say, well, this isn't really going to affect the election, I will remind you that 2 years ago, the difference between a Clinton and a Trump presidency was 80,000 votes in three states. And so the margins are thin. And when you can get eyes, millions and millions of eyes, onto this types of misinformation.
And get the right eyes, the way social media can.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what social media is designed to do, which is target advertising. I don't think it's out of the question that these misinformation campaigns can interfere with our democratic elections. And no matter which side of the political spectrum you're on, I think that should give you pause.
Well, it's not a First Amendment issue. The government is not trying to infringe upon speech, but it's an issue of a private company having to make decisions about protected speech.
Yeah. Well, this is where we get into some interesting landscape. So first of all, taking down the video is not a violation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall not impinge, not YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. And in fact, when Facebook was defending their decision to leave the video up, they said repeatedly, this does not violate our terms of service. And I think they should go back and read their terms of service because I did. And in fact, I have it right in front of me now. And it says that you may not share anything that is misleading, discriminatory, or fraudulent. How is this video not misleading or fraudulent? Now, if the video was posted as satire or political commentary or comedy, then sure, that's not misleading or fraudulent, but it was not. It was labeled as, this is Speaker Pelosi, she is drunk and we should impeach her, and that's how the video was promoted.
Mm-hmm.
It directly and unambiguously violated their terms of service. And that's true, by the way, of Twitter, and it's true of YouTube. Only YouTube took it down, and Facebook continues to defend it, despite it being, I think, clearly a violation of their terms of service. And this is an easy case. This is a really simple case where there is no question that this is fraudulent. It's no question what the intent was, and Facebook didn't get it right. And that should give us real pause coming into the 2020s when we are going to start seeing more of this and probably more complexity and nuance. And of course we want a vigorous debate online. Of course we want people to be able to disagree. And have debate, but that's not what this is, and I think they just got it wrong.
Do you think they just can't do it? That they'd have to? Well, they can, of course. They have, their resources are phenomenal. That they could if they wanted to, but it takes human resources to do this kind of a thing.
Yeah, no, they absolutely could have done this. And I will remind you, by the way, when Facebook comes up and says, "Well, we are all about the First Amendment," you should ask them, well, why do they then ban adult pornography on their site, which they do, as does YouTube? And they do that because it's bad for business. So they can't claim that they're all about First Amendment free speech and then ban protected speech.
And
so they absolutely could have done this. They chose not to do it, and that's very different.
So they're saying that the video doesn't violate policy because the videos aren't required to be accurate or true. You're saying that's the opposite of what their policy says.
I'm literally looking at it on my computer right now. It's that's not what the policy says. So either change the policy and then deal with the consequence of that or enforce your rules. But I think that they just got it wrong on this one, and YouTube got it right, and Twitter, as usual, is just silent on the matter.
I think CNET's reporting today that the video was removed from Facebook, but Facebook denies that it removed the video. How in the world would I know? Nobody else can remove it but Facebook, right?
Well, yeah. So users can remove posts if they want to.
Well, yeah.
But now, at this point now, the video has spread so many times that it's hard to know, where it gets at any point. And here's the other thing, too, is, so this story's about a week old now, and 3 million plus some views. Now, at this point, it doesn't matter if you take it down. The harm is done. And this is what's really important to understand, is that at the speed of the internet, that even after, if you wait a day or 2 days to take things down, you will have exposed millions of people to it. And people don't remember the fact check. That's not the way the world works. They've seen the video. They maybe remember there's some controversy about it, but they move on to the next news cycle. And so the speed at which you have to actually get this right is phenomenal and complex. And the problem with the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Twitters of the world is that they have built these global platforms to the tune of billions of users, and they have not put the proper safeguards and guardrails in place from the beginning. They were built to expand as quickly as possible, to profit as quickly as possible, and they ignored the safety issues. And now they're having to come back to a very complex and large system and try to put the safeguards in place. And it's a really hard problem, they're not able to do it.
But are they not? They say that, is it impossible?
I don't think it's impossible. I think it's a question of priority. I think they've made it more difficult than if they had put the safeguards in the beginning. I think it is incredibly difficult because these are global companies dealing with policies and laws that are incredibly diverse around the world. They are dealing with, on YouTube, 500 hours of video a minute, on Facebook, hundreds of thousands of images a minute being uploaded. And so it is a large-scale problem. But as you said, these are phenomenally wealthy companies with phenomenal resources. They're choosing not to put the bulk of the resources where I think they need to be on in securing their platform. So I think it is a hard problem, but I also think they're not really putting huge efforts into dealing with these because, frankly, it's not profitable for them.
And people seem to just sort of kind of laugh it off. I mean, they just kind of think, well, I know that's fake. I'm not going to worry about it. And you're saying the way social media works is the people who don't get it and aren't checking the sources, it is affecting their viewpoint.
It is. Look, I'm still getting email from people who insist that the video is real.
Wow.
And this is an easy case where the real video is out there. You can go look at it.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's true that everybody dismisses it. I do think that it is still gaining traction. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And we know there are going to be misinformation campaigns in the coming months in the lead up. We've seen this over the last 2 years, and we know that they've been effective. So I think there's no reason not to think that we're going to keep seeing these campaigns.
Well, Hani Farid, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I really appreciate your time.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Hani Farid, he's a computer science professor at UC Berkeley. He focuses on digital forensics and image analysis. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
And WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Peak tornado season in Ohio typically extends from April through July. Dayton took a serious hit on Memorial Day. Besides the issues of food, water, and shelter, technology can play a role. Mark Peterson is Director of External Affairs for Region 5 of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which includes Ohio. He joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Bowers is the Communications Director for Red Cross Ohio, Buckeye Region. She joins us by phone. Welcome.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
It used to be the phones went down with everything else during a natural disaster. And Jennifer Bowers, I wonder if you could tell us, when did that start to change?
Well, I tell you what, I'm coming to you from Salina, Ohio, right now in Mercer County, where they were hit badly by the tornado a week ago. Mm-hmm. And you know, when the power goes down, when people are trying to get back on their feet, obviously that's tricky. But now, with the advent of smartphones, people are able to, you know, get the information that they might not be able to get off of a television or radio that could be life-saving. So fortunately, they can, you know, obtain weather information as well as safety and emergency information right on their smartphones.
And for FEMA, Mark Peterson, when did the phone start to come into play?
Yeah, well, we started getting into the smartphone space back in about 2011 when we launched the FEMA app. And it's a great resource, you know, that we tried to sort of pull a variety of different pieces of information into that one resource that is sort of known and backed by FEMA. There's a number of apps out there that do similar sorts of things. But, you know, this is an app that will provide you with those weather alerts right there. You can, you know, set the location of where you are or loved ones are up to five locations and get that information and then also share it. Mm-hmm. But even before a storm takes place, the FEMA app has a lot of resources on how to prepare for up to 25 different types of weather threats or just threats in general.
So it's something you want to check out beforehand.
Yeah, and the nice thing about at least FEMA's app is that it's offline information. So if data services go down, cell services go down, you just open your app on your smartphone and you've got a lot of that information that tells you what to do. You know, there are some features that you do need cell and data mm-hmm. service, but not all of them, which is kind of nice.
And Jennifer Bowers, what about the Red Cross? How did you tap into the smartphone? I assume you have an app as well.
We do too, yes. So FEMA is one of our valued partners. So shout out to FEMA. We're able to work together closely when there are disasters like here in Salina. Mm-hmm. But yes, with the app, definitely we've got a Red Cross emergency app, and then we have a bunch of individual apps for emergency, hurricane, tornado, earthquake. Wherever you are in the world, there's something that's going to target you. And just like Mark was saying, you're able to access it very easily from your phone. And another really cool thing is it also connects you to social media. So, for instance, you can check in. We've got a Safe and Well site that people can, when they're in a tornado, they can mark themselves as safe and well and then post it right from their phone onto Twitter or Facebook so their family can see that. So that's very powerful, too.
I think that's probably one of the most incredible things about it because we're all familiar with the bulletin boards now after a big disaster and when people are missing and that kind of a thing or they're without communication devices. So tell us about Safe and Well a little bit more, Jennifer Bowers. How do people use it? Do they – because I'm not sure. I'd never heard of it before.
Ah, okay. Well, the Red Cross is all about preparedness. We try to get people as prepared as possible so that when the unthinkable happens, they have a plan and they're ready. So Safe and Well, they can go to safeandwell.org, or they can go to redcross.org/safeandwell, or just search it in Google. And you can set up a little account. It's all private. So you're just putting your name and contact information for your family. So like in Salina here, when the tornado hit, somebody could go to safeandwell.org and say, I'm okay, and then click on the icon that would then post that to Facebook and Twitter. So their friends will see that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And friends and family.
Is there anything out there in the in the digital universe, Mark Peterson, that tells people where they can go plug their phone in? Because when power goes out, so does the phone eventually.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting or important thing to think about when we're talking about the immediate post event when power is down. In some cases, you still may have some cell service and data service, and that's why social media is just an incredible resource right now. And that's why we encourage everybody, say right now, to take a moment, look at the people that you follow or the entities that you follow, and think about the trusted sources in your neighborhood, whether it be your local fire department or police department or emergency management. Those folks are going to be the ones who are going to be pushing out important information immediately following a storm that is reliable. And that's the most important thing. You know, we don't want – social media is a fantastic tool, but it also can lead to some misinformation. Mm. So you want to make sure that you're really following those trusted sources. Red Cross is another one. And they're going to be sharing information about, say, if there's a need to evacuate an area, but also potentially areas where people can get help, like you said, like, you know, where power is up, where there's a cooling station in the heat, right? Things like that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about how technology can help us prepare for and respond when there's been a disaster. If you have a question or comment, my guest, Mark Peterson, he's Director of External Affairs for Region 5 of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and also Jennifer Bowers, she's Communications Director for Red Cross Ohio Buckeye Region, which includes, of course, Central Ohio, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And by the way, we'll post links to both of those apps on our website at wosu.org/allsides. When we think about all the different kinds of disasters, most of us think about things like natural disasters. Is that mostly what FEMA is concerned with, Mark?
Well, I have to say that FEMA is we're a robust agency, and we're constantly looking at all of the threats out there, whether it's natural or man-made. The bulk of the work that we really do is in the natural space. And so the threats that we see around the country, you know, they vary by location. Mm-hmm. And that's why when we talk about preparedness, it is so important that people know their specific risk. Whether you are in an area that is prone to, severe storms, obviously everybody's kind of prone to severe storms, but some areas are maybe more prone to tornadoes. Mm-hmm. You kind of, you know, instinctually think of those areas.
And at certain times of the year, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's tools out there to help you understand those risks, whether it's with the weather service. The FEMA app also has some information that helps you understand that. But even more importantly, and specifically to the point of, say, flooding, which is the number one disaster around the country, FEMA has resources through floodsmart.gov that actually let you understand the actual flood risk for your property. And that's really important because you need to take steps to, mitigate that risk by purchasing flood insurance or doing certain things to your home that potentially would lessen the financial impact of that that event.
Jennifer Bowers, what kind of prompts are there on the app to tell people what to do, like maybe check on neighbors? I don't know, things that they might not be thinking about in the chaos of a big disaster.
Well, one really excellent tool is the shelter finder. So, if your house just got destroyed and you're trying to figure out where to go, what to do with my family, you can go right on the app and find where a shelter would be in your area. You just have to have the location device on, and you will be able to find where it's safe to go. You know, with the response phase, you can get the meals and shelter and even spiritual and mental help. So that's very powerful.
When I talked with people who lived through Katrina in particularly some of the really, really hard hit neighborhoods, they said that it was a complete failure, it was a complete meltdown, that they went to the schools where they thought there would be help and there was nobody there, that kind of a thing. And obviously, Katrina's just catastrophic in and of itself.
Yeah.
But Mark and Jennifer, what are the worst? You said that flooding is the most common, Mark Peterson. Is it one of the biggest, hardest ones to deal with, too?
It's different for every storm.
Okay.
And frankly, an emergency to one individual is a disaster, whether or not it's declared by the federal government or not, it's a disaster, right? Whether you had a house fire to a flood event to a tornado, potentially destroying your home. Those are impacts that we can't really measure in terms of saying this is validated by a declaration or not.
One of the things that complicates things as well is the loss of documents. And technology can help us with that, can it not?
It absolutely can. And that is one of our best tips that we have. We have a resource, ready.gov, that provides these types of tips. And also they have really simple checklists to help you work through the important documents that you might want to consider digitizing.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to save those documents on a thumb drive or in the cloud, but also take one more step and maybe create them as a PDF and then password protect them.
Hmm.
So even if you did lose your...
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. I wanted to say a little something about misinformation because, social media is amazing for getting information out there, but it can also spread rumors and things that need to be monitored. And so when a big disaster happens, we do have people monitoring the social media and the mentions of Red Cross. And actually, we learn what maybe we're not doing right and what we might need to correct. And then we can kind of correct the record, using Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and get people the resources that they need. So like in Salina right now, there was some confusion over where people could go for certain things. And we were able to post all over Facebook. And then fortunately, now they're starting to share and like it. And it shoots down the rumors and puts the right information out there.
All within the same vein of misinformation. And I think that's a fabulous point. There's also misinformation that can be created by just not getting in contact with your loved ones who are worried about you. So we always encourage individuals who have been affected by these storms and maybe the power's down or the cell service is down, use text messaging. Uses less bandwidth. It's always a faster way of getting in touch with one another. So think about those things.
Yes. And if people can't get in touch with their loved ones, let's say they're using Safe and Well, they're texting, like Mark said, they're trying social media, they can always contact the Red Cross to initiate an emergency welfare inquiry. And they just call 1-800-RED-CROSS, and our folks will go out and try to contact their loved one.
Yeah, I was thinking about particularly older people who either are harder of hearing, that kind of a thing. Are there any apps out there for people who are hearing impaired, who are speaking impaired, who have communication impairments? Mark Peterson?
Yeah, I'll let the Red Cross talk about their specific.
Yeah, Jennifer Bowers?
Well, they have, and I'm afraid I'm just not well-versed on it, but if you're hearing impaired, there is a number that you can call, and they can translate for you and help you out. As far as the apps go, fortunately, they're very visual. So you're going to be able to find that information pretty much regardless. So, if you have a parent or a grandparent who isn't really, up to speed on using their smartphone, download those apps, download FEMA, download Red Cross for them, teach them how to use it. It's really important, and it could save a life.
Hmm.
And, let me say, these smartphones are incredibly powerful devices, and they provide a wealth of information, right at your fingertips. But we also encourage people, once they know their risk and they've put together sort of a plan of what they'll do in an event like this, to have a kit. And sometimes the fallback is to have, you know, sort of these analog devices, like a weather radio that you can crank, right?
The Eton.
Yeah, sure. And and also, you know, a crank flashlight.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, it's possible you run out of batteries, mm-hmm. you know, just in your home. And, you know, these are good devices just to have on hand so you're able to get
around. I'm actually thinking, I usually don't have my phone with me at night. I keep it downstairs. But I'm wondering, is that wise? If you need your phone and something happens, you get hit by a tornado, you don't know if you're going to be able to find it.
If you've ever experienced... Sorry, go ahead, Jennifer.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
You know, if you've ever experienced your wireless emergency alert go off, it's mm-hmm. pretty loud. So it's possible you'll hear it downstairs, assuming you have it turned on. You know, a lot of these alerts do make quite a bit of noise. So, you know, you may hear it downstairs, but it's always good to have it at least within earshot.
Yeah, because it could be lost in the shuffle. Yeah, Jennifer Bowers.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Mark. I live in Pickaway County in Circleville, and when the Memorial Day tornadoes struck, we got a couple down there, too. I had my phone plugged in by my bedside, but boy, was that loud. The emergency alert really, okay.
And this is
really,
such,
really woke me up.
It's such an important conversation, too, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about outdoor warning sirens.
Yeah.
They are intended for outdoors. So when storms are approaching...
And you have your windows shut.
Exactly. And so it's important to know how you're going to get those alerts if severe weather is pending or forecast in your area within your home.
Is there anything on the horizon that you're working on at FEMA with technology to help people?
Yeah, we're always working on improving both our FEMA app to provide, you know, the tools that we can give individuals. We're improving our risk information. Flood maps are getting constantly being improved and getting more specific in terms of the actual flood risk for any location. We're also, and the Red Cross can probably speak to this too, we're also improving our communications with the public through social media. We have, you know, a podcast now that is really kind of helping people understand what risks are out there and what the federal government and FEMA and its partners are doing to help mitigate those risks.
When towers go down, is there anything that they're working on to slap those babies back up ASAP?
Yeah, we work with a lot of partners through the state to work with cell phone carriers to sort of ease the access way to get those phone lines back up. Yeah,
that's a priority now.
It is. It's always a priority for the state. I mean, communications is certainly one of our core areas to look at following a disaster.
Let's see. Kevin in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Just have a quick little tip. When our power went out a couple years ago for several days, just at night we saw our light source, which was our solar garden lights, our patio lights. And we just picked them up, brought them inside, put them in a vase, and they were lights. They were
great idea.
Know, they'd last for, 7 or 8 hours. So people don't think about those, but they are really, they make great emergency lights.
I love it.
Yeah, I
idea.
Remember when we actually had a generator. Someone loaned us a generator at when Ike hit some years ago, and we had our power out for 2 weeks. And people would like moths. They would go up and just stand in our kitchen next to the light.
The ingenuity that comes out from survivors following these events is just incredible. Mm-hmm. But also people who are facing the threat of storms come up with really ingenious ways of preparing. You know, I've heard of in the hurricane areas, a lot of people will fill up like 2-liter bottles and put them in their freezer so that they turn to big blocks of ice. Well, that allows their freezer or refrigerator to stay cooler longer to keep their medicines refrigerated.
Yeah, and fortunately they share these tips on social media, so
incredible.
Word gets out. So that's fantastic.
Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. The other night when we had that warning, I was in the other room from the TV, and I was hearing doorbells, and I'm going, what the hell is that? And I kept hearing doorbells instead of the bleh, bleh that you usually hear.
What was it?
And I don't know what the hell. It was the warning. And it was coming through on my TV as a doorbell.
Oh, it
and
sounded differently.
Coming
okay.
across as that horrendous noise that he just pointed out that you should listen for.
Well, did it alert you?
Yeah, but I wasn't alerted.
Okay, you
I was in the other room, and I didn't go in the other room.
Oh.
I went, why the hell do I keep hearing doorbells coming out of my TV?
Well, let's hear, I mean, Mark Peterson, what's the science of what alerts us?
You know, I don't know the specific noise that was heard there, but I'm certainly glad that he was made aware of impending threat, or made him say, watch the storms, the forecast. You know, the science has gotten so improved between the weather service and even your local news, the meteorologists that are getting their information fed from different locations. It's incredible what we can find now. And that's another reason why the smartphone is just such an incredible device right now. I mean, think about how many apps that you probably have on your phone right now where you can see pinpointed radar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, even if you're sort of an armchair meteorologist, you know where severe weather is potentially going to, you know, move through your area. And that's just an incredible resource.
Yeah, think about back in the day how many people died before alerts. You know, you're right, Mark. It's absolutely incredible, just at our fingertips, the amount of information that we can access.
Jennifer Bowers, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ann.
Jennifer Bowers is Communication Director for Red Cross Ohio Buckeye Region. And Mark Peterson, thanks to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Peterson is Director of External Affairs for Region 5 of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. And that's the region that includes Ohio. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple has announced a new iPad operating system at its highly anticipated Worldwide Developers Conference, which started yesterday. The new OS features improved text editing, a new home screen, and online browsing features. Joining us now is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
I heard somebody or read someone describe it as it looked like a cheese grater. What's going on?
Oh, no, that's the Mac Pro. That's going to be the next thing that we talk about.
Okay, all right. Tell us about the iPad OS.
The iPad has always kind of had a really funny relationship within Apple because it started off running the exact same version of the operating system that the iPhone was running, which basically meant that it was really just a big iPhone, and that was clumsy when it first came out and caused a lot of problems and didn't always look great when trying to take those iPad apps and make them giant. And over time, Apple has worked really hard to work with developers to make sure that things look different on the iPad than they do on the iPhone. And in fact, has created this you know, niche little ecosystem where there are people who use the iPad as their first computer. You know, they don't have a traditional laptop or desktop. They do most of their computing when they're not, you know, in an office on an iPad. And so Apple has been working really hard to push the software for the iPad a little further each generation so that it's a little more functional and does things a little differently. And they finally kind of come out and said it at WWDC this year that the iPad has now got its own version, its own operating system, its own set of rules that are going to be different from the way that things work on the iPad, the way things work on the iPhone. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, kind of this now in between, what they do on the phone and what Apple does on laptops, you know, have this kind of third operating system that they use for computing.
What's better about the editing?
Yeah, so I mean, a big part of what has not worked well on the iPad when trying to use it for, you know, kind of day-to-day use for me in particular is having access to a proper file system. So like if I download something from the internet and go to open it in another application, it's actually a lot of work to get that to work on an iPad compared to a MacBook or a Windows laptop or something like that. You know, if someone sends me an attachment in an email and I need to edit that thing and send it back, it actually is kind of complicated depending on you know the collection of apps that you have. And it's one of the things that has kind of held this system back for quite a while, on top of not having a web browser that works like a desktop web browser. So these are, you know, some of the smaller things that are being addressed in this new version of the operating system is making it so that it has these tools that make it feel more like a proper computer environment.
The home screen is being streamlined. What is that about?
Yeah, so on an iPhone and on an iPad, the home screen that we have known for years has just been, you know, rows of icons.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, you can collect those things into folders, and then you just have rows of folders instead. And that works for something small that you hold in your hand. It's really just not super functional for things that you have, on a larger display. Apple's tried to, solve for this over the last couple of years by adding a dock on the bottom of the iPad screen that did a little more and allowed for apps to run kind of side by side so that you could, kind of function, with multiple apps in the same space. But the home screen has never been super useful for anyone who owns an iPad. So they're giving, space for some of the things that you already see on a Mac, for things like, a quick glance at how, your email is behaving, or a quick glance at some activities that you might want to perform for things like controlling smart lights in your house or Siri suggestions and things like that, will exist in these kind of sidebar designs instead of having this just kind of row of icons that you're used to.
You know, it's by making it more of a proper computer, more like the Mac and everything, it sounds like they're trying to. A lot of people have an Apple phone who don't have the rest of, the rest of the gear. They don't have the Mac. They use something different. It sounds like it's going to make it easier or make it more attractive to people to switch to a Mac as well.
Yeah, so I mean, this has been kind of the complicated, promise that Apple has been making for a while now, is if you have the entire Apple ecosystem, you can do some really cool stuff within that entire Apple ecosystem. But mm-hmm. asking to do so is really expensive.
Yeah.
People can often get an iPhone from their carrier for, $30 or $40 a month, and not really think about that as a $1,000 investment that they put into it. But a MacBook starts at, around $1,100. And you have to pay for all of that up front. So not everyone who gets an iPhone is going to get a MacBook. But the iPad can now be sold in that same format where you can buy it from AT&T or you can buy it from Apple for that kind of monthly payment. And that just puts you that kind of one step further into the ecosystem.
All right. So speaking of Mac, Apple announced a new design for the Mac Pro, and that's what I'm confusing with the cheese grater reference.
There have been a lot of people who have made fun of this thing for being a cheese grater. It's actually a kind of a funny throwback to not the previous Mac Pro, but actually the one before it, the Mac desktops. There were these aluminum Mac desktops that used to have a very similar look to this, where they kind of had this cheese grater front where it was all all silver with these holes. And this certainly looks more like a cheese grater than its predecessor. But this is a extremely serious machine for professionals. This is not something that Apple is selling to, consumers who just occasionally browse Facebook or play the occasional video game. This is, the people who are going to buy 150 of these for a processing room in Pixar someone who has a very high-end photography studio that they work out of, or someone who does, kind of videography or 3D design on their own. These people have been in the Apple ecosystem for a while, and the problem that a lot of these companies have had, a lot of these individual companies have had with Apple over the last couple of years, is that it's very difficult to buy a high-end machine from them that will be expandable and can support kind of higher-end hardware that you get from Windows environments. And so, this is almost an apology letter to that audience, because that audience has not been seen as a priority for Apple for a couple of years now. And so the Mac Pro is you know, kind of a push in that direction. But it is so clear by the hardware that's in it and the obscene price tags associated to it that this is something that, you know, you're not going to see in most people's houses.
It starts at $6,000 $6,000.
This starts at $6,000 for just the computer,
right?
In a very base configuration, and actually, when it is fully equipped, we actually went through and pushed all of the buttons on the Apple website last night to confirm this. A fully equipped, completely maxed out version of this computer with its display is $35,000.
Oh my goodness! Okay, never mind. Anything else before we move on from the Apple reveal?
No, I mean, there's just so many different things that Apple has announced over the last 24 hours that come with it. But these, I feel like, are kind of the two biggest things. Is that, you know, Apple is doing a lot of really important things here, but it's probably not going to be for everyone.
I'm curious about, is it Tesla that is getting a game called Cuphead? What's going on there?
This is the silliest thing, and as much as I enjoy kind of whimsical, silly things, this is kind of borderline too much. So Cuphead is a game that came out for the Xbox 2 years ago, and it is tremendously popular, albeit just endlessly frustrating to play, because it's one of those games that's just kind of difficult on purpose. It's a lot of fun, but it's one of these things that, you know, you have to kind of pace yourself, otherwise you get very angry, and it is many controllers have been broken over this game. That much I can promise you. Apparently, Elon Musk is a fan of Cuphead and decided that he would work with the creators of Cuphead to include the game in the operating system for Tesla cars.
So how in the world?
So, you know, most Tesla vehicles, actually all Tesla vehicles, have a large kind of central display. Mm-hmm. You know, they're vertical displays in almost every instance, the Model 3 being the first that was kind of horizontal and looked more like a television. But the it's a large display inside of each one of these things, almost like a television. And there have been kind of silly little Easter eggs that have been hidden throughout, you know, the game, you know, system as you go through and you set up, you know, all kinds of different things, you know, within the system, including like its auto driving system. All of that gets controlled through this central thing. And apparently, if you connect a USB controller, you will be able to play Cuphead on your car as though your car were an Xbox.
Is this wise?
It's really not, for a couple of reasons. One, a lot of the vertical displays just mean that you're not going to get a particularly large display to enjoy Cuphead on to begin with. Cuphead is just one of these games that really, really frustrates you, and I don't really know that I want to associate Road Rage and Cuphead Rage in kind of physical place. Those should be a hard line separating those kind of people. But, you know, there's also some questions that haven't been asked, that haven't been answered about when this game is going to be available to people, if this is something that someone would be able to do while the vehicle is in motion. Mm-hmm. There's a general assumption that the answer is no, that this is not something that would be possible while the vehicle is in motion, but, you know, it's not been tested yet because it's not available, won't be available until later. But yeah, it's an odd thing to see. You know, this is not the first time that a silly thing has shown up in the Tesla operating system. You know, there was an Atari game called Lunar Lander that you could play on the touchscreen, but it was this kind of very simple thing that you would do for 3 seconds and kind of laugh about. Cuphead is a full game that you can play for hours.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's odd and kind of fascinating.
We have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to squeeze in your talk about the Lenovo alarm clock. It's a smart alarm clock. What's smart about it?
Yeah, so this actually takes an entire Google Home system, the smart speaker system, and adds a display to the front of it and makes it the size of an alarm clock. So unlike some of the larger smart displays that you're encouraged to kind of set up in a kitchen and do a bunch of things with that have, you know, kind of cameras and that sort of thing built into it, this is a small camera-free display with a very powerful speaker on the end of it and some very cool, you know, kind of display tech that allows you to, you know, kind of set it up in your room, in your bedroom without, you know, kind of feeling like you've got Big Brother staring over your shoulder while you're sleeping. And some of the features are actually kind of clever. The display itself has a rising wake-up feature along with your alarm clock. So the alarm will, you know, kind of start slow and low and actually get brighter. But as it's getting brighter, the display itself will actually brighten as though the sun were rising.
Okay.
To go along with, you know, to kind of help with waking you up. It has access to all of your Google Assistant things. So, you know, accessing the weather, controlling smart lights, you know, doing all of those things are all possible through this as well.
All right. Well, Russell Holley, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it, as always. You bet. It's Russell Holley, Android Central Contributing Editor. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.